Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into a really big one, a foundational text in political thought, Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France.
Yeah, it's quite the undertaking. We've been looking at a solid summary and some specific pieces focusing on his ideas about, you know, tradition versus change.
And our goal here, our mission for this deep dive, is pretty clear. We want to pull out the core insights from Burke's, well, conservative take on revolution, help you understand why he pushed for gradual reform over just tearing everything down.
And it's so relevant, isn't it? I mean, this tension Burke talks about, slow evolution versus radical upheaval, It's not just history.
Not at all.
It really, it sheds light on so many debates happening right now about social and political change. Understanding Burke gives you a kind of shortcut, you know, helps you get informed on these ideas that just keep coming back. Hopefully you'll have some aha moments.
I really think so. Okay, so before we jump into the deep end of the book, let's talk about the man himself. Edmund Burke, born 1729 in Dublin, died 1797. He wasn't just a thinker and a study, was he?
Oh, absolutely not. Far from it. Burke was an Irish-born British statesman, an economist, a pretty powerful speaker, and a political philosopher. And crucially, he spent nearly 30 years as a member of Parliament in the British House of Commons.
Right. So he was in it?
Totally. His ideas weren't dreamt up in an ivory tower. They were shaped by the real, practical, often messy business of 18th century politics.
And that direct experience, that really gives his views a unique edge, doesn't it? I mean, he supported the American colonists.
He did, but, and this is key, he based it on their inherited rights as Englishmen, not some abstract universal rights of man. That's a really important distinction for Burke.
Okay. And he also backed Catholic emancipation in Ireland, even led an impeachment against Warren Hastings for misconduct in India. So he wasn't afraid of change or challenging authority.
Not at all. But his focus was always on reform within the existing system, building on it, improving it, not demolishing it.
Right. So reforming within the framework.
Exactly. And this perspective really stood out when the French Revolution kicked off. Lots of people, his contemporaries, were initially quite excited about it.
Yeah, you hear that a lot.
But Burke, he saw the danger almost immediately. He recognized its radical and potentially destructive nature right from the start.
And his foresight here is just, well, it's kind of stunning, almost prophetic. He actually predicted a lot of what happened later.
He really did, including the rise of a military dictator, You know, the man on horseback figure. Mm-hmm. He saw that coming years before Napoleon actually took power.
Wow, that alone makes you sit up and listen, doesn't it? It gives him a particular kind of authority on this subject.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
It's pretty rare to find that kind of clear-sightedness about long-term effects when everyone else is caught up in the, you know, the ideological fervor of the moment. It points to a deep grasp of human nature, maybe, and how politics actually works.
Okay, so let's shift focus to the book itself. Reflections on the Revolution in France.
It wasn't just a theoretical essay, right? It came from somewhere specific.
That's right. The spark, the catalyst, was a sermon by a guy named Dr. Richard Price. He was a well-known minister, and he praised the French Revolution.
Okay.
But the crucial thing, the thing that really got Burke going, was that Price drew this parallel between what was happening in France and England's own glorious revolution of 1688.
And Burke saw that as a dangerous comparison.
Deeply dangerous. Yeah. He felt he absolutely had to step in and explain the fundamental differences between, in his view, legitimate reform and just, well, destructive revolution.
And the way he did it is interesting, too. It's not a dry treatise. It's actually framed as this long, quite passionate letter to a young French nobleman.
Yeah, it's very personal in tone sometimes. His goal was really to warn people in Britain, intellectuals, politicians, the educated public, against catching that revolutionary fever. He wanted to show them the dangers compared to Britain's own more gradual evolutionary path. So what's the core argument? What's the central idea he's hammering home?
At its heart, it's this. Trying to radically remake society based on abstract ideas, on pure theory, is incredibly dangerous. Destructive, even.
Okay.
Burke saw society more like a living thing, an organism. It grows and evolves slowly over time through experience, through customs, through tradition. You can't just rip it apart and rebuild it based on a blueprint like it's a machine.
That's a powerful image, the organism versus the machine.
Exactly. For him, the wisdom built up over generations, the stuff embedded in our institutions and traditions, that's far more valuable than any philosopher's speculative theories cooked up in a study.
Yeah.
You have to nurture the ecosystem, not bulldoze it.
So the big question he's tackling is really how societies ought to change. Is it slow, careful evolution, or radical, sudden transformation? And he's making a very strong case for the first one.
He is, passionately. And the book covers so much ground. It's not just about France. It's this broader meditation on human nature, tradition, religion, rights versus duties, even government finance. It's really a cornerstone of conservative thought.
Okay, let's dig into that core distinction then. This comparison between England's Glorious Revolution and the French Revolution. Why was Price's comparison so wrong, so dangerous, according to Burke?
Well, Burke's whole point was that 1688 in England was fundamentally conservative. It was about restoration.
Restoration. How so?
He argued it was about preserving the ancient constitution, the inherited rights and freedoms. It basically corrected the course of the monarchy to keep the existing system, the hereditary line, intact. It was reform within the structure to ensure continuity.
Okay, preserving things.
Exactly. Whereas the French Revolution, he saw that as the complete opposite. Radical destruction. It was driven by these abstract universal rights, completely detached from history, and it showed a real contempt for tradition.
So one preserved, the other destroyed. That's the fundamental difference for him.
That's the core distinction, yeah. It really underlines his whole view of society as this living thing that you have to tend carefully. You can nurture it, maybe prune it a bit, but you can't just hack it down and hope something better springs up from bare earth.
That idea of the living organism keeps coming back, and this connects to his view of tradition, right? Institutions, customs they represent, accumulated wisdom.
Precisely. Tested, refined over generations. And this leads to his famous defense of prejudice, which, yeah, sounds really bad to us today.
Yeah, prejudice has seriously negative connotations now. What did he mean by it?
He didn't mean bigotry, not in our modern sense. He meant prejudgments, like the ingrained, almost instinctive wisdom a society develops, the kind of hidden knowledge embedded in customs and habits that pure abstract reason might overlook or dismiss too quickly.
Interesting. So like gut feelings or common sense built up over time?
Kind of. It raises this really interesting question for us, doesn't it? How much wisdom do we just sort of inherit through our culture, through these prejudices that actually helps guide us? And what happens if we just toss it all out? Do we lose our compass?
So for Burke, these weren't just random habits. They were potentially more reliable guides for how to act virtuously than, say, some philosopher's cold calculations.
Exactly. He valued that lived collective experience over the perhaps brilliant but untested theories of individuals.
Which brings us right to his critique of abstract reasoning, especially things like the rights of man.
Right. This was a central pillar of his argument. These metaphysical rights, as he called them, things like the abstract rights of man, he thought when you separate them from actual history, from practical reality, they become meaningless at best.
And dangerous at worst.
And potentially very dangerous in real-world governing. They're too general, too vague to guide specific decisions, he thought. And worse, they could be twisted to justify almost any radical action, ignoring the potential consequences.
So what about all those grand declarations of universal rights we still talk about today? Burke would say they need grounding.
He'd argue they need to be grounded in concrete reality.
Yeah.
For him, real rights weren't abstract universals. They are specific, tangible benefits that you get from living in a particular civil society, secured by its traditions and institutions, like the specific rights of Englishmen, developed over centuries, not some universal declaration dreamed up overnight.
So rights emerge from history and practice, not just abstract thought.
That was his view. These abstract principles, he argued, could actually pave the way for tyranny because they weren't anchored in the practical wisdom of how societies actually function and sustain themselves.
And Burke didn't just theorize. He pointed to specific destructive consequences he saw unfolding from the revolutionaries' policies in France, especially economically.
Oh, definitely. He was scathing about the confiscation of church lands. He saw it not just as an attack on property rights, which was bad enough, but also as crippling the church's ability to provide charity and education, which were, you know, vital social supports back then.
Right. They played a huge role.
And then there was the whole fiasco with the assignats.
Yeah.
The paper money they issued, backed by those seized lands. Burke predicted, accurately, it would lead to runaway inflation and basically ruin the economy. He understood how finance, property, and social stability were all interconnected.
It wasn't just economics, though. He saw a deeper rot setting in, socially and morally.
Absolutely. He wrote about the tearing down of traditional hierarchies, the attempts to force equality by decree, which he thought would just level everyone down, not lift them up, and the attack on the Catholic Church. For Burke, that wasn't just about religion. It was undermining the very basis of morality and social order.
And he famously lamented a kind of cultural loss, too, right? The age of chivalry comment?
Yes, his famous line, the age of chivalry is gone. He used the example of the treatment of Marie Antoinette to symbolize something bigger, the destruction of an unwritten code. A code of honor, deference, manners, things he believed had softened power and civilized European society for centuries. That loss, he felt, was profound.
All this dismantling economic, social, cultural sounds like a recipe for political chaos.
And he saw that clearly. He criticized their new administrative map, the departements erasing old local identities with these purely rational geometric boundaries. He worried about inexperienced leaders taking charge in the National Assembly, people without practical governing wisdom, and he saw the danger of politicizing the army.
It's like he saw them systematically pulling out all the Jenga blocks holding the structure up.
That's a great analogy. He saw them dismantling the interconnected pillars, property, religion, tradition, hierarchy, manners that he believed held European civilization together. And the inevitable result, in his view, was collapse, followed by tyranny.
Which connects to another really profound idea in Burke, this concept of the social contract spanning generations.
Ah, yes. This is so central to his whole philosophy. His famous quote sums it up. Society is a partnership not only between those who are living, but between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born.
Wow. So it's not just about us here and now.
Not at all. For Burke, each generation has duties. Obligations to those who came before to honor their legacy, the institutions they built, and obligations to those who will come after to preserve their inheritance. Trying to radically remake everything in one generation, that violates this sacred pact. It treats society like it belongs only to the living, ignoring the past and the future.
That's a very sobering thought. And as we mentioned, Burke wasn't just diagnosing problems in the present. He was predicting the future with, frankly, chilling accuracy.
His predictions were really quite remarkable. He foresaw that destroying the existing legitimate authority would create chaos, and that chaos would eventually lead to military despotism, that popular general stepping in to restore order, but at the cost of freedom.
Which is exactly what happened with Napoleon.
Precisely. He also predicted the revolution would get more radical, more violent, which led straight into the Reign of Terror. And he warned that this wasn't just France's problem. It was a threat to the stability of all of Europe, to civilization itself.
And making these calls years before the Terror and Napoleon really does cement his reputation for, well, deep political insight. It's like he understood the underlying dynamics, the human psychology involved.
Exactly. He was applying lessons from history, observing human nature, and seeing the predictable patterns that maybe others, caught up in the revolutionary excitement, just couldn't or wouldn't see.
Okay, so let's try to boil this down. As we wrap up our look at Burke's arguments, what are the big enduring takeaways from Reflections? First, clearly, is this deep respect for tradition.
Yeah, the wisdom of tradition and what he called prescription. The idea that tradition isn't just old habits, it's the accumulated, tested wisdom of generations. A valuable inheritance we should handle with care, improve cautiously, not just throw away. It holds insights that pure reason might miss.
And second, the flip side. The danger of relying solely on abstract theory in politics.
Right. Applying these metaphysical ideas, like the abstract rights of man, directly to governing, without considering the specific context, the history, the complexities of real human beings, Burke argued that leads straight to violence and tyranny. It ignores our imperfections.
And that core metaphor again, society as an organism, not a machine.
Yes, that organic versus mechanical view. Okay. Society is this complex, living thing that grows slowly. Trying to redesign it totally from scratch is like taking a scalpel to a living body based on a textbook diagram instead of carefully nurturing its health. It's a powerful warning against, you know, political arrogance.
And finally, his emphasis on prudence.
Prudence as the key political virtue. Being cautious, thinking about consequences, respecting the context, preferring gradual, practical fixes over big, untested, radical changes. For Burke, the job of a statesman is to keep the ship steady, preserve the health of the whole society for the long haul.
Reflections is just packed with memorable lines, isn't it? Let's revisit a couple that really captured these ideas. That one about the social contract is just so powerful.
It really is.
Yeah.
Society is indeed a contract. It is a partnership in all science, a partnership in all art, a partnership in every virtue and in all perfection. As the ends of such a partnership cannot be obtained in many generations, it becomes a partnership not only between those who are living, but between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born. It just perfectly captures that sense of multi-generational duty.
And that lament for the age of chivalry, it's so evocative, even if a bit dramatic.
The age of chivalry is gone. That of sophisters, economists, and calculators has succeeded, and the glory of Europe is extinguished forever. Yeah, it's dramatic, but it signals his fear that something vital, honor, manners, things that soften power was being lost, replaced by cold, hard calculation. A real cultural shift, he mourned.
And this one really challenges our modern ideas about freedom. But what is liberty without wisdom and without virtue? It is the greatest of all possible evils, for it is folly, vice, and madness without tuition or restraint.
That's potent. He's saying freedom isn't an absolute good on its own. Without morality, without wisdom, without some form of restraint, it just descends into chaos, and ironically, often leads back to tyranny. True liberty needs structure.
It's amazing how these ideas from the 1790s still resonate. How can we, you know, apply Burke's thinking today in politics, maybe even in other areas?
Well, in politics, leaders can definitely take a page from Burke's book on prudence. You know, really think through the difference between necessary reform and just blowing things up. Focus on building consensus, respecting what came before. Think about successful changes. Often they build on what's already there. They don't try to reinvent the wheel completely every time.
Yeah, avoids unintended consequences, maybe. What about outside politics, like in business? There's so much talk about disruption.
Right. Burke would probably look at some of that and say, hold on a second. His idea suggests caution about radically overhauling, say, a company's culture or discarding institutional knowledge just to chase the latest trend. Maybe value that steady, continuous improvement like Heisen, respecting the company's history and the experience of long-term employees. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, basically.
That makes sense. And maybe even in community work. Lasting change often comes from working with existing structures and traditions, not just imposing new models from the outside.
Exactly. Understanding the local context, the existing relationships, that's crucial for change that actually sticks and doesn't cause resentment or fall apart.
And maybe even personally. His ideas seem to favor gradual growth over trying to totally reinvent ourselves overnight.
Yeah, I think so. Cultivating good habits slowly, learning from experience, maybe appreciating where you came from, your family, your culture as guides. It's about building carefully on your foundation, not trying to become someone completely different every few years, which, let's be honest, rarely works anyway.
That's a really useful way to think about it. And his framework definitely helps analyze things happening now. You can look at a political movement and ask those Burkean questions. Does it respect institutions? Is it just slogans or practical goals? Does it aim to unite or just divide and destroy? It encourages a more thoughtful kind of citizenship. You know, what really struck me during this deep dive, what I kind of loved about Burke's perspective, was that incredible foresight we talked about. Seeing the chaos, the despotism coming years down the line, it really makes you appreciate the value of historical understanding and maybe the dangers of ignoring it for shiny new theories.
Well, for me, the most valuable lesson from Burke is this need for balance, that delicate dance between continuity and change. It's not about being anti-change, but about being wise about how we change. Respecting the past, adapting carefully to the present, that's where true progress lies, perhaps, not in wholesale rejection or blind revolution, but in that prudent navigation. And his emphasis on the non-rational stuff, the emotional, the spiritual bonds holding society together, it's a powerful critique of just trying to manage everything by spreadsheets and logic alone.
So, a final thought for you, our listener, to chew on. How much of our constant push for progress today might be accidentally chipping away at those valuable traditions, those prejudices in Burke's sense, that actually quietly help hold our society together? What are the real stakes when we choose between building completely anew versus carefully renovating the old house in our own lives and for our shared future? See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.